Hello, friends, and welcome to the Worst Foot Forward Tea Room. I'm Ben Vanderveld, this week's Oolong Sommelier, and I will be joined by my own little tea leaf, Barry McStay, as we take you on another tour of all things aromatic and biscuit based in this week's Third Foot, as we take a deep dive into the tea urn of history. How are you, my bosom buddy?
Oh, looking forward to diving into a tea urn. That's yeah, we're doing this because as people who've been paying attention to our podcast feed and social media will be aware, we've got a live show coming up on the 5th of November with Laura Lex, who's returning to the podcast. And the previous time we had her on the show, we talked about the world's worst tea. So we're honouring Laura with a tea ceremony of sorts.
Yes, we are. When we did it, I think the world's worst tea, was it the prison tea that we found? Or was it...
Oh, we talked about the prison tea in Russia, I think you talked about. I think I talked about a guy who'd smuggled tea out of India. There was mentions of bubble tea.
Yeah.
The world of tea is highly political and charged.
The bubble tea as well. That was, I think, did we not find sub-zero bubble tea with liquid nitrogen?
Yeah. But it's a shame we didn't have scorpion bubble tea to go with.
Indeed, because you order that tea and the tea business says, get over here! You'll be unsurprised to know the world of tea has got an even deeper dive. That's awful English. You'll be unsurprised to know that the world of tea is a never-ending cornucopia of intrigue and oddness. And we're going to share some of the things that didn't get into our main episode on this one, whilst also encouraging you both now, and perhaps in the middle, and also at the end, to buy tickets for our live show on Sunday, November the 5th at midday with Laura Lex and her brother, Ron, where we will probably be drinking tea, but we'll be discussing the world's worst siblings. And you can buy tickets for that by going to the Cheerful Earful podcast. Now, with the first YouTube pop-up ad done, we're going to go back to ancient China, which we certainly did talk about China on our original tea podcast, but I'm not sure we talked about the mythical origins of tea. Do you know about these?
Ooh. Is it the tears of some sort of long-forgotten
real
beast?
Real good guess. It is not, however. It is said that it was created by Shen Nong, and Shen Nong is a Chinese deity, variously translated as divine farmer or divine husbandman. And he was a...
nickname for my husband.
The divine husbandman.
Divine husbandman.
Yes. He was a mythological ruler who sort of became a deity within Chinese folklore. And he has been at times counted among the three sovereigns, who were like a group of ancient wise deified kings in prehistoric China. And what Shenong brought to the table was that he taught the ancient Chinese not only about their practices of agriculture, but also having invented various tools. He invented the plough, the axe, and the hoe. He taught them how to dig wells, irrigate the land, store seeds by using boiled horse urine. The secret of trade, commerce, money. He even created the weekly farmers market, so you have him to thank for gentrification. And
this guy sounds great. You know, most modern rulers, you know, cut a ribbon outside a supermarket and then wave off a balcony now and again. This guy is getting out and about.
He is also credited with inventing the agriculture of marijuana, so gets my vote.
I like the idea that this guy seems to, like, he's discovered tea and he's discovered weed. But, I mean, there's so many different leaves and grasses and herbs out there. Like, how far down the list did he get before he discovered that this one goes in the water and this one goes rolled up in paper?
Well, I imagine he was, either the knowledge was intuitive in him, or he was an ancient king. He had a lot of time on his hands. More time once he'd smoked the first doobie. And he was happy to just go by trial and error. Now, legend says that Shen Nong had a transparent body and therefore could see the effect of different plants and herbs on himself. So that's his experimentation.
So he's like Wonder Woman's plane or that toaster that everyone wants when they're a teenager.
Precisely. Precisely. And his discovery of tea came from when he found it to act as an antidote against various poisonous effects of some of the herbs that he tested on his body. So clearly, he swallowed some poisonous root and he looked inside his body and went, uh-oh, the liver's expanding. Quick, drink that. No, that failed. What about this beaker? This looks delicious.
Wow. That's great. How much of him was transparent? But that's a vital question, really. Is it just, can you see through the skin and muscle and therefore you get, like, you just have the organs, you don't have the interior of the organs? Is he just a skeleton? Or is he essentially invisible and all you see is, like, slowly digesting food floating around in front of you?
I don't know. It's one of those ones where, you know, like the Greek myths of, it's all very well to wish for immortality, but you have to remember to wish for eternal youth as well. And it's kind of like, it's all very well saying he's see-through, but how see-through? Are we getting organs? Are we getting bones? As you say, is he just floating food and saliva? Or is he just a bag of viscera? I don't know.
Yeah.
Scholars of Chinese mythology, why are you listening to this podcast? But if you are, do get in touch. he's also, because in my mind, he's not just see-through, he's like sort of a... you know those plastic bags that you win a goldfish from in the fair? In my mind, he's like a deified version of that. And so...
Oh my God. Did he swallow some tea leaves and then someone said, I've had a brilliant idea for how we get this stuff into the water and get it back out again. And they invented the tea bag.
Well, no, they say he swallowed the tea leaves and then he had a drink of water and someone said, try having that water a bit hotter. And slowly he turned a lovely sort of red colour. Now have some milk.
That's the only way they could see him.
Or maybe they were like, oh God, you're see-through. We need to see you here. Have some milk first. What are you doing, you monster? that obviously wouldn't work because they didn't have dairy farming in China. But it's a nice idea. Anyway, keep in mind... he is see-through, he's a plastic bag, he's got fish swimming around inside him. You're going to love this next piece of fact about him. He is also believed to have introduced the technique of acupuncture. Uh-oh, Shenong's going to burst.
Oh, God. He's like a kerplunk game. A plastic receptacle you just stick various
things through.
The Chinese
god kerplunk. I mean, kerplunk is definitely definitely an Eastern European god. Yeah. Next, I found some stuff about the most famous British tea company, who is, of course...
Twinings.
Yes,
Twinings,
who certainly profited from the East India Company. I don't know if they are sort of like the... friendly public face of the horrendous colonial enterprise. But I found out about a couple of Twinings. Thomas Twining was the founder, and Twining was, it's the first known tea room. It was opened in 1706 on the Strand. Twining holds one other first, or not first, one other oldest. Something was created in 1787 for Twining, and is believed to be the oldest continuous what in the world?
Sweepstakes. Do they have sweepstakes for their staff? They had a long-running stage play, secretly being performed in the back room of their tea room.
I would be utterly delighted if that was true, but no, very simply, the logo. They have the longest running logo in the world.
Oh.
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah.
Good for them.
But I want to talk about one particular Twining who is, I'm not quite sure how many notches down the family tree he is, but I imagine he's maybe probably a great-great-grandson of Thomas Twining.
Were there any twins in the Twining family tree?
No, not that I know of. But I want to tell you about Edward Francis Twining, later known as Sir Edward Twining, later also a baron, but we'll get on to that.
Oh yeah, Baron Teddy Twining. Yeah.
Oh God, he's in all the Woodhouse books, isn't he? Born 1899, died 1967, led quite the life. Biggest sort of claim to fame in literature is that in 1960, he published a book titled A History of the Crown Jewels of Europe. It's 700 pages long, pretty extensive. You can enjoy it over several nice cuppers. His first sort of impact on the global stage is between 1919 and 1922, when he served as part of the Worcestershire Regiment in Dublin. Now, what political faux pas do you think he committed?
Being the English army in Ireland during the...
Yeah, basically that. He accidentally arrested Eamon de Valera.
I mean, that very much smacks of accidentally on purpose, let's be honest.
Well, perhaps. But I'm working off limited sources here, but I get the impression that by the very, very low standards of the British Empire, I think he might have been a good guy. So let me... Yeah, I mean, I appreciate I haven't convinced you so far. So, following his work in Ireland, he worked in Uganda with the King's African Rifles, and then moved to Mauritius in 1939. And obviously, Mauritius was a really important strategic place to be during World War II. because
that's what they told you. it's really important to go to Mauritius. Oh, why is that, Jenkins? Like signals and shit.
Yeah. I'm just going on a strategic honeymoon for 6 years.
Yeah.
Have to drink a lot of strategic rum. I believe there might be a Nazi dodo somewhere on the island that I have to track down.
It's a spying mini-moon.
Yes. So, at first, he was intercepting signals from Vichy France, which were being sent out from Madagascar and the Reunion Islands. So it does make sense. And then obviously, once the Japanese entered the war in 1941, it again became a very, very important place to intercept their signals. My favourite story about one of his assistants is that his sister-in-law, Evelyn Dubuisson, arrived in Mauritius in 1939 just for a summer holiday and stayed for most of the war after she discovered a talent for code-breaking. How convenient, Evelyn.
Evelyn Fish.
Yeah. Oh, no, Dubuisson, not Poisson.
Oh, I thought you said Dubuisson.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I mean, Evelyn the Fish is a great member of the French underworld.
Yeah.
It was so valuable as an intercept station that it was recognised by the Royal Navy and even Bletchley Park. And in order to enhance his capabilities, three of the graduates of the secret Bedford Japanese School, run by Captain Oswald Tuck, were sent out to Mauritius. And they were trained not only in Japanese, but in code breaking. And his operation was hidden by the Official Secrets Act until long after the war, and he didn't mention it at all in his autobiography. But he tired of his work in Mauritius, and so in 1943, he became administrator in St. Lucia. How convenient.
Finally, it's about time I got back and did some actual bally hard work.
Yes, exactly.
So, to St. Lucia.
Do you know what? I tire of this Indian Ocean rum. I think some Caribbean rum.
Yes.
He then, having worked in St. Lucia for 3 years, was appointed governor of North Borneo at the end of 1946. And he served there. And in 1949, he moved again to Tanganyika, is that Tanzania now?
Yeah, it's in Tanzania. Yes.
And he served there until 1958. And at this point, we're going to take a little detour because I want to tell you about Chief Mukwawa, who is sort of a tribal leader in that part of the world. Who I'm going to tell you his full name because I'm going to have a go at it is Chief Mukwayinyika Munyigumba Mwamuyinga, which is a hell of a tongue twister.
A lot of syllables.
Yeah, and he was the tribal leader of the Hihi tribe in German East Africa, and he opposed German colonization. In 1891, a German commissioner called Emil von Zalewski led about 320 soldiers to try and suppress the Hihi resistance. Completely failed because they were attacked by a 3,000-strong army, and Wawa's army overpowered them and killed Zalewski. 3 years later, the Germans, under a new leader, Friedrich von Schiele, attacked Mkwawa's fortress, and they took the fort, but Mkwawa managed to escape. And he then conducted a campaign of guerrilla warfare against the Germans for a further 4 years. Ultimately, though, July 1898, he was surrounded, and rather than be captured, he shot himself, and his body was buried a few metres away. However, after his death, the German soldiers tracked down his body and removed his head, and the skull was sent to Berlin and ended up in a museum in Bremen. Now, fast forward to 1918, the then British administrator of German East Africa, a chap called Horace Byatt, proposed to his government that it should demand a return of the skull to Tanganyika to reward the Wahihi for their cooperation, which is, I mean, good manners, but also ahead of its time, returning artifacts to Africa in the early
20th century. A literal head of its time.
A literal head of its time. And it was agreed that it should be returned to Tanganyika. And in which document is it specifically stipulated?
Oh, it's not the armistice, is it?
It is in the Treaty of Versailles. Article 246 of the Treaty of Versailles says, within 6 months from the coming into force of the present treaty, Germany will hand over to His Britannic Majesty's government the skull of Sultan Mkwawa, which was removed from the protectorate of German East Africa and taken to Germany.
Oh, for the love of God. Oh. Colonial powers are shits, aren't they?
I mean, well, you say that. Like,
it's like they're going, we're going to sort out this war thing, but also let's do some colonial housekeeping. All of us, let's just get together and like decide which trinkets we've taken that need to go back.
Yeah, it's not great, but I do like that in amongst all of the fine print and terms and conditions of the Treaty of Versailles, there's a random skull that has to be repatriated. There was an awful lot of back and forth between the British and Germans, both over this and generally between 1919 and 1945. And so it wasn't returned until 1953 under the auspices of the governor of Tanganyika, Sir Edward Twining. And he worked closely with Bremen Museum to locate the skull because, sad fact, there were 2,000 skulls in the museum, 84 of which originated from German East Africa. And so they worked really closely to find out which skull, work out which one had a bullet hole, which obviously came from the chief having killed himself in the dimensions. And then, on the 9th of July 1954, it was returned to the Wahihi tribe, and it now resides in the Mkwawa Memorial Museum in Kalenga.
At some point, when you are conducting a literal head count of your 2,000 pet skulls, narrowing it down to the 84 from one country and then trying to find which one has the correct bullet hole in it, at some point along that path you might go, wait a second, are we the bad guys?
Yeah. There is a staggering lack of self-reflection in a lot of colonialism, but by the low standards of colonialism, I think Twining was trying to do right. He retired from the diplomatic service in 1958 and became a life peer with an absolute banger of a title. If I am ever appointed to the House of Lords, this is the sort of title I want. He was Baron Twining of Tanganyika and Godalming.
Godalming is a small coastal village in Sussex, isn't it?
No, it is a small not coastal village in Surrey. But
nevertheless,
Baron of East Africa and Surrey really sums up everything that's wrong with colonialism. But it seems that, again, by the standards of the time, when he came back, you know, late 50s, early 60s, this is when sort of decolonization is really starting to get some speed, and some of it went well. You could argue in places like West Africa, Ghana, some of it went fucking horrendously, like in Kenya with the Mau Mau uprising. But it seems that he, again, seems reasonably ahead of his time, warning that Westminster shouldn't try and impose its own political model on Africa, rather that local leaders should be allowed to draft their own party political arrangements to articulate independence movements.
Well, that's a little bit better, because up to now, the only thing I can see that he's done to merit his baronetcy is arrested an Irish freedom fighter, played a game of colonial Guess Who, and got a suntan. So,
I mean, that's at least three peerages for that. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
and also, after the large amount of displacement that was caused via independence in Africa, Twining was one of the peers who asked the Commonwealth Office to donate more money to alleviate the world refugee crisis. So I'm going to say, by the standards of his time, it's a score draw.
Well, they won't be ripping his portrait down in Twining HQ anytime soon.
I'm a little bit sad that I couldn't convince a passport-holding Irishman of the small shards of sunlight within the colonial story.
De Valera had it lucky, because he was born in America, you see. That was his literal get-out-of-jail-free card.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's why they didn't shoot him after the 1916 Rising.
Oh, because it might have angered the Yankees.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Huh. Okay, well, I mean, as is so often the way in global politics in the 20th and 21st century, have an American passport and it'll get you out of all sorts of trouble.
Yeah.
Well, let's instead go to Utah. Do you know what the Utah teapot is?
It's a building.
It's not. We're going to talk about ones like that later. No, the Utah teapot, you have absolutely seen it, I'm pretty certain, as a child of the 80s and 90s. So it is a...
Oh, is it like a rock structure that appears in the back of lots of westerns or something?
Really good guess, but no. There is a famous teapot-based structure that... is in, I can't remember which state it's in America, but I'm not going to talk about it today because there's not that much interesting to say about it. But no, the Utah teapot, it's a 3D imaging test model that has become a standard reference object within the computer graphics community. So in 1975, a computer graphics researcher called Martin Newell was looking for something that he could teach his 3D programs to model, and so he could, and also so he could see whether they were working accurately in displaying shapes on the screen. And what he needed was a simple mathematical model of a familiar object, and his wife suggested modeling their tea set, since they were sitting down for tea at the time. And it turned out that the teapot shape was really useful because it contained a number of elements that were good to test. So it was round, it contained saddle points, it had the hole in the handle, which was difficult to do. So all sorts of different complex shapes for a model to do. And it's now become like a standard measurement in the graphic world of, can you do the Utah teapot? And it's become a bit of...
it's just a jump to the right.
Yeah.
And a jump to the farther right.
Oh, dear. Well, also, yeah, the I'm a little Utah teapot is an extremely chaste nursery rhyme.
Salty and stout.
Yeah.
Here's my wife, here's my other wife. I'm so sorry. That's... very outdated and stereotypical of me.
But also true. You will have seen it possibly on an old laptop. You know the Microsoft Windows Pipes screensaver?
Sometimes
the teapot turns up in it. And it's such an in-joke that it's appeared in the background of Toy Story, where it's in the short tea party scene. It's appeared in The Simpsons Treehouse of Horror 6, in which Homer discovers the third dimension. And in The Sims 2, a picture of the Utah teapot is one of the paintings available to buy in-game.
Yeah, nice. So is it kind of like, you know, to be able to do graphics design 101, you should be able to, you know, on your computer, you should be able to do this, a bit like artists should be able to draw the human form or bowls of fruit, that sort of like standard test. Nice.
Yeah, precisely that. A little bit of religion before we end with some science. We're going to go to Malaysia, and we're going to find out...
You've got to have your religion greens before you can have your science dessert.
Yes, precisely that. I mean, I think we all know that science is really greens and religion is incredibly florid,
it's,
baroque dessert.
It's very Moorish.
Very Moorish, very bad. Well, you know, so... This was a Malaysian religious commune and sect founded by a man called Arifin Muhammad, who became known as Ayapin. He was a Muslim by birth, but he claimed to have direct contact with the heavens and is believed by his followers to be the reincarnation of Jesus, Buddha, Shiva and Muhammad. A hell of a Matryoshka doll of reincarnation there. And as cults go, and I feel like I'm doing a lot of qualifiers in this episode, he seems to have been one of the good-er guys along the lines of wanting to promote ecumenical dialogue and interreligious harmony.
Right.
He may also have had four wives at the same time, but nevertheless, he tried to also encompass notions of interventionist angels, spiritual healing, dreaming.
Oh, nice. So angels who step off your shoulder and actually get stuff done.
Yeah, precisely.
Rather than just whisper in your ear. Nice.
He also co-opted into his religion local folk beliefs of the Orang Bunyan, who are supernatural fairies of the forest. Obviously, Orang means forest in Bornean, because Orang Utan literally means man of the forest. So far, so enjoyably culty. He built a commune. Within the commune, there were some notable symbols there, one of which was a two-story-high cream-coloured teapot. The reason being is that it was said to symbolise the purity of water and love pouring from heaven. And it is believed to be the earthly model of a celestial prototype. So while Bertrand Russell was going on about a teapot orbiting the earth that as his sort of proof that deism is nonsense because you could just say it's there and people would then have to disprove it, this guy clearly heard that and went, I think Russell's onto something.
I think what's happened here is, like the wife of that graphic designer and probably Bertrand Russell, he just saw the first thing that came into his eye line over breakfast on a day he had a deadline to hit and went, that'll do.
Yeah, could be. Well, I mean, listen, I think we can all agree using it as a expletive, like, God's teapot, McStay.
Yeah. Also, nothing screams purity of water than a teapot. Something to which you definitively contaminate water with.
Yes, and that you add a patina to. Hmm. What do you think would be the Lord's brew?
Oh, a lovely innocent smoothie.
Yeah, sure. I like that. Innocent smoothie is the perfect example of looks and sounds delightful, but is actually very tainted in various different ways. To end, we're going to talk about chocolate teapots.
Ah, excellent.
As I'm sure you and the listeners will know, chocolate teapots are renowned as a byword for uselessness.
Has anyone... I'm assuming you're leading up to us that people have made this, but it's literally the first thing that came into my head when you said that was, you know, when you go to those... You see these like posh restaurants where occasionally they'll have a dish where they've made like a little nest that goes over the food, mm-hmm. and then they pour like a hot sauce over it and it melts the nest. Has there been a dessert that is essentially a chocolate teapot into which you pour more molten chocolate or something?
Not to my knowledge. This has not made it out of the laboratory. Because first, alas. Let me tell you about Simon Bradshaw, Amanda Baker, Bridget Bradshaw, John Bray, Gordon Brignall, David Clements and Del Cotter, who have written an appraisal of the utility of a chocolate teapot.
And who refuse to work with anyone whose initials go any further down the alphabet than C. Yeah.
I mean, the ABC scientists are definitely baddies in 1960s Batman.
Yes. Batman, you might be wondering how we came to make this incredible poison. Well, we used only boron and carbon.
And let's not forget the arsenic. they have written... in their paper, the chocolate teapot remains popular as a general comparative standard for failure. However, while numerous items are colloquially labelled as being as useful as a chocolate teapot, there does not appear to be any objective standard for the usefulness or indeed uselessness of a chocolate teapot. In the absence of any British, European or ANSI standard for this important but poorly specified reference item, it was decided to conduct an independent assessment of exactly how much use one of them was. The first step in this research program was the acquisition of a chocolate teapot. Common usage of this term is frustratingly vague, in that neither the volumetric capacity of the reference standard teapot or the type of chocolate used are specified. However, the Cheltenham branch of Marks and Spencers were able to supply a chocolate teapot. In the absence of any alternative samples of evaluation, this example was taken as a representative of chocolate teapots in general. So,
I'm so sorry, but these, how many of them? Eight? Nine yes. of them got pissed at a Christmas party, had a look to see how much money was left in their government grant and went, well, we better spend it before the tax year ends.
Yep, absolutely. So they got the chocolate tea, but they discovered, unsurprisingly, that it was small and also not designed for practical use. So they had to carve in apertures for filling in
sorry,
for
I could have told you that without having to literally write an academic paper.
And, well, and they had to use, in their words, a thermally enhanced cutting implement to allow for the moulded lid to be detached.
A hot knife?
Yes, a hot knife. Well done. Additional equipment used for this experiment comprised a Sainsbury's round tea bag, see figure 2, and a 400 millilitres of consumer-grade HTO heated by approximately 370 kelvins.
Oh, fuck, I love them using the saying that they heated the water in kelvins just to try and make it sound more scientific.
Experimental results. The first evidence of loss of containment was observed at approximately T plus 5 seconds in the form of a major leak in the vicinity of the handle, see figure 5. By T plus 10 seconds, major structural failure was clearly in progress, see figure 6. This had reached catastrophic proportions by T plus 15 seconds with total loss of H2O containment, see figure 7. Conclusions. On the basis of this test, we felt it safe to conclude that, in respect of its suitability for the role that its design suggests, a chocolate teapot is of no use at all. As such, such an item should serve as an excellent baseline of uselessness against which to compare other similarly dysfunctional items. However, Barry...
If I may...
You may.
Just to peer review these, and I very much think of myself as a peer of these idiots... Have they at any point in the paper defined what usefulness is?
Oh dear me, they have not. But that is quite a foggy, unscientific term. I mean, useful as a distraction, then it's very useful.
Yeah. But they've not defined utility within the bounds of this experiment they're conducting. So they're saying that a chocolate teapot doesn't. Sort of match a standard of usefulness if they haven't actually defined usefulness in the first places. And I think it's at this point that I realise that every now and again when we're on this podcast, we'll go, obviously we're not scientists, so we sort of do down the academic rigour of our podcast. But then again, academic papers like this exist.
Well, precisely. And the thing is, this isn't the end of the discussion, because I found a different paper that suggested...
Of course you did.
The real key of this is the thickness of the chocolate. And these very clever scientists... They got some Perspex tubes and they stuck a plug of chocolate at the end of them, ranging in size from 10 millimetres to 80 millimetres. They then poured hot water down and timed how long it would take the plug to melt. And it turns out that a 10 millimetre plug of dark chocolate melted after about 3 minutes, almost as long as it takes to brew a pot of tea. And so they decided to make a 20 millimetre thick or 2 centimetre thick chocolate teapot. It used about 1.3 kilograms of chocolate. It looks abysmal, but it is nevertheless a teapot. And whilst after half a minute the lid started to melt, the rest of the teapot remained structurally sound. And so these people, who sadly I couldn't find their names, so I'm not able to credit them properly, but what happened is...
Discredit them, I think.
Yes. is that because the walls were so thick, there is a layer of molten chocolate at the bottom that does melt, but it acts as a protective insulating layer from the bottom of the chocolate teapot and so allows you to boil water and make tea. And the tea, they said, tastes odd. Odd and
yes,
sweet
of chocolate,
and slightly
I imagine.
Chocolatey. But nevertheless, this chocolate teapot, I put it to you, my lord, and people of the jury, is not useless.
I put it to you that what they've invented there is a chocolate hot chocolate pot rather than a chocolate teapot. Why we've decided that we want to have a chocolate teapot when hot chocolate as a hot drink is there looking at us right in the face is beyond me. It's like inventing a tea chocolate pot.
We can't really criticise them for spending their time in that way, considering that we've just spent half an hour of our time in this way, and you, listener, have just wasted half an hour of your time listening to this.
All of these people who say, oh, you know, you can achieve anything, like celebrities and sports people and people who are born with certain advantages, they say you can achieve anything. It's these people who pen academic papers dressed up with a few statistics and some Kelvins. They're the people who can say you can achieve anything.
Yes.
They're the people you should be inspired by.
Yes, you should be. Well, people who have set themselves a relatively low bar.
Did they win an Ig Nobel Prize for their endeavours?
I think the first group did get a mention in the old Iggies, as they are not
good,
known.
Good, good.
So they were featured in the Annals of Improbable Research, who I think are certainly connected to the Ig Nobel Prize.
Right.
But I don't know whether they actually gained a nomination. So, again, if anyone wants to let us know on that, please do. But if they have managed that accolade, they've at least been featured on this very silly podcast. So there is all the extra daft things that I found about teapots, tea, and the joys of colonialism, which
thank you very much indeed
is a pamphlet. I think we can all agree. As we said at the start, and I will reiterate now, this podcast was brought to you on this occasion by our lovely Patreon listeners. Thank you, each and every one of you. And also brought in inspiration by the fact that we are welcoming the brilliant Laurel X back to guest with us on our live show on November the 5th at midday at the Bedford Pub in Balham as part of the Cheerful Earful Podcast Festival. I'm reasonably certain that you can either buy tickets for us or tickets for the whole day and go see an array of genuinely excellent podcasts, including Laura's own Lex Education. So,
although they're sold out, so if you want to see Laura specifically, you got to come to our show to get a taste of it.
Are they sold out already?
Yeah, I believe they are, yeah.
Bloody hell. All right, well, don't go and see Lex Education. Do come and see us, because we haven't sold out yet.
And at time of recording.
At time of recording. And do you know what? Bring your own chocolate teapots along. Until next time, enjoy dunking your biscuits. And, oh, God, and there's a whole world of scientific exploration about the correct angle with which to dunk your biscuit. I will not bore you to tears with. But may your biscuits be well dunked and your chocolate teapots structurally sound.